The deep recession that ended in June 2009 has been followed by a very tepid recovery. Economic activity has grown, but slowly, from levels far below the productive capacity of the economy. With demand growth barely keeping pace with firms' abilities to increase productivity, job creation has been too weak to significantly reduce unemployment, which stands today at 9.6%. And as is typical in such circumstances of considerable slack, the rate of inflation has declined. Viewed through the lens of the Federal Reserve's dual mandate, pursuit of the highest level of employment consistent with price stability, the current situation is wholly unsatisfactory. Given the outlook that the upturn appears likely to strengthen only gradually, it will likely be several years before employment and inflation return to levels consistent with the Federal Reserve's dual mandate. Today, I will discuss why the recovery has been disappointing and highlight some of the issues facing the Federal Reserve and monetary policy, echoing some of the themes laid out by Chairman Bernanke in his Jackson Hole speech in late August. As always, what I'm going to say reflects my own views. It does not necessarily reflect the views of the Federal Open Market Committee or the Federal Reserve System. In recent quarters, the pace of growth has been disappointing, even relative to our modest expectations at the start of the year. After rising at about a 3.25% annual rate during the second half of 2009, there has been a progressive slowing to 2.75% annual rate during the first half of the year, and very likely to an even slower rate in the third quarter. The factors responsible for the failure of the economy to pick up speed include, one, the gradual petering out of the contribution from the swing in inventories from rapid liquidation in the first half of 2009 to a modest increase in the second quarter of 2010. Two, the sluggish recovery in consumer spending, and three, the continued weakness in housing. Normally, at this stage of the recovery, the handoff from growth led by inventory accumulation to growth led by private final demand would have been more fully accomplished. This handoff has been delayed because households have been paying down their debt, a process known as deleveraging. In addition, many businesses have been reluctant to hire. This has limited income growth. Slow income growth, along with caution in the face of economic uncertainty, has also restrained spending. Although so-called soft patches are quite common during the early stages of an economic expansion, this soft patch is a bit different. First, it probably will last somewhat longer because the deleveraging process is not yet complete. Second, the current weakness is somewhat more concerning because it's occurring at a time that the central bank has already cut interest rates to near zero. In fact, this failure of the recovery to catch fire has occurred despite aggressive monetary policy and fiscal policy steps to stimulate the economy. On the monetary policy side, short-term interest rates have been nearly zero for a year and a half. The Fed purchased $1.7 trillion of long-term assets, and the proceeds from maturing securities are being reinvested to keep the balance sheet from shrinking unduly. On the fiscal side, a series of measures have provided support to a broad range of activities. The sluggish nature of the recovery in the face of very substantial stimulus reflects the dynamics at work during the expansion that preceded it. Beginning around 2003, underwriting standards for residential mortgages were significantly relaxed, and this led to a sharp rise in household borrowing and in home prices. The two trends were inextricably linked. The rise in home prices helped to support additional demand for credit as households used the collateral represented by their homes to borrow large sums of money via home equity lines and second mortgages. Chart 1 illustrates how the growing proportion of non-prime first mortgage loans helped fuel the sharp rise in home prices. As home prices rose and the stock market performed strongly, household net worth rose sharply. Households responded by borrowing more and saving less. After all, why save when the rise in home prices was adding to your wealth and the housing equity created by the rise in home prices could be easily tapped for funds as needed? The use of home equity as a source of funds to support consumption is evident in the fact that homeowners' equity as a share of home values was essentially flat over this period. This is shown in chart 2. This indicates that homeowners were borrowing against their accumulated gains. The surge in home prices pushed up the ratio of household net worth to disposable income to nearly 640%, and the personal savings rate fell below 2%. This is shown in chart 3. The surge in home prices was fueled by products and practices in the financial sector that led to a rapid and unsustainable buildup in leverage and an underpricing of risk during this period. These dynamics, in turn, provide the fuel that caused home prices and consumer spending to rise much faster than income. As shown in chart 4, the share of GDP accounted for by consumption and residential investment climbed to a peak of 76% in 2005, up from 71% in the mid-1990s. The boom, of course, was unsustainable. The progressive easing of underwriting standards that was needed to support housing demand could persist only as long as underwriting practices were progressively relaxed in order to generate more buyers. When home prices began to slip beginning in 2006, the dynamics swung in reverse. The collateral values supporting borrowing and spending began to fall. As bank credit losses began to mount, credit availability became impaired, and this exacerbated the downward pressure on home prices and on borrowing and spending. Not only did households that had overextended themselves have to cut back, others also retrenched because they were affected by the declines in wealth and heightened uncertainty about the economic outlook and their job prospects. It's not surprising that the workout from the excesses of this type of boom would take a long time. Just as it took several years for the boom to begin and run its course, so it would take years, not months, for households and financial firms to adjust their balance sheets and behavior to the new environment. Households had to raise their savings rates in order to rebuild their balance sheets. Banks had to replenish their capital to replace losses via loan charge-offs and other credit impairments. Both adjustments would need to occur before the economy could grow rapidly. With this in mind, the two key questions are, one, where are we in the adjustment process? And two, what, if anything, can monetary policy do to facilitate a smoother adjustment and more rapid progress towards our dual mandate objectives? In terms of the adjustment process, starting on the household side, most signs point to significant progress. For example, the revisions to the national income and product accounts that were announced in July revealed substantial upward revisions to the personal savings rate. This is shown in chart 5. The current savings rate is broadly consistent with the historical relationship between personal savings and the household net worth to income ratio. Of course, part of this story depends on the stabilization of household net worth, which had earlier fallen sharply due to declines in both home and equity prices. Although household net worth dropped significantly again in the second quarter, according to the flow of funds accounts, the subsequent rise in the U.S. equity market is likely to have reversed that decline. Meanwhile, housing price declines have moderated substantially, helped in part by the fact that the low level of mortgage rates, combined with the sharp drop in home prices, has resulted in a sharp improvement in affordability. This is shown in chart 6. Households have retrenched in terms of their borrowing, and this has helped push down the household debt-to-income ratio sharply from its peak in 2007. Another factor behind the fall in this debt-to-income ratio has been credit losses and debt forgiveness. Since 2007, charge-offs have reduced household debt outstanding by over $880 billion. Some argue that the decline in the house debt-to-income ratio must go much further before the deleveraging process can be complete. After all, the house debt-to-income ratio is still far above the level reached as late as 2002, before the surge in household borrowing began. Some even argue that the household debt-to-income ratio must fall back to the level of the 1980s. I think that is an overly pessimistic view for a simple reason. Both household debt and household financial assets have been rising faster than income growth on a secular basis since the 1950s. Focusing just on debt misses what is happening on the other side of the balance sheet, which is shown in chart 7. One reason why both households' assets and debt have been rising faster than income is due to greater financial intermediation. For instance, tax incentives encourage people to fund their 401k plans rather than pay down mortgage debt as they get older. The notion that the household adjustment process is well advanced is also supported by other data. For example, the share of after-tax income devoted to servicing debts, as well as paying property taxes and homeowners insurance and rent, has declined sharply over the past 2 years and is now back to levels that prevailed in the late 1990s. This is shown in chart 8. In addition to the declining stock of debt, households have been able to refinance outstanding debt at lower interest rates. Moreover, mortgage delinquency rates, even in the most serious categories, have started to fall. And data that tracks changes in the proportion of borrowers who are delinquent and then becoming current versus those who are becoming delinquent and then becoming more delinquent is encouraging. These trends are shown in charts 9 and 10. Finally, the less serious delinquencies for credit card, auto, and student loans have been trending lower, although this is not the case for more serious delinquencies. This is shown in chart 11. Of course, these recent improvements have come in the context of the stabilization in employment and house prices. To ensure that the more favorable trends in household balance sheets continue, the economic environment needs to become more supportive. We also should recognize that there's still considerable uncertainty about the level of the savings rate and the configuration of household balance sheets that will prevail in coming years. It is possible that households now perceive the world to be a riskier place than they did before, and they want to have more rainy day funds as a consequence. More saving may also be needed to meet higher down payment requirements for home purchases. Thus, while we may be far along in the adjustment process, it is difficult to judge just how much further we have to go. Turning now to the issue of credit availability, there's no question that credit conditions are still tight. There are a number of impediments. Financial institutions, many of which still face balance sheet problems of their own, have tightened underwriting standards. And a decline in property prices has cut collateral values and made the refinancing of many residential and commercial mortgages more difficult. On the banking side, there is considerable differentiation across the industry in terms of health. The largest banks in the United States are generally in much improved condition following the Supervisory Capital Assessment Process, or SCAP, in 2008, which led to substantial additional equity raising. For smaller banks, the situation is more mixed. According to the FDIC, at the end of June, more than 800 of the nation's nearly 8,000 commercial banks and savings institutions remained on the FDIC's problem institution list. But overall, the situation is one in which credit availability is slowly improving. According to the Federal Reserve's Senior Loan Officer Survey, the percentage of banks reporting that they were tightening credit standards across a wide range of lending categories peaked in late 2008. The most recent data indicate that virtually no banks are tightening credit standards, and a number of banks have begun to relax credit terms. This is shown in chart 12. In addition to households, the small business sector is another area that has seen a contraction in credit. Focus groups and surveys conducted by the Federal Reserve suggest that this contraction is a result of three distinct factors: a decline in demand for credit, a tightening of lending standards, and a weakening of credit quality due to lower collateral values and cash flows. Which is the most difficult of these three factors is difficult to discern. However, surveys of small business owners indicate that much of the weakness in lending to the sector reflects a lack of demand on their part. The National Federation of Independent Business, for instance, asks its members to indicate the single most important problem from a list. For some time now, the response, poor sales, has been the most frequently cited problem. In contrast, relatively few respondents cite financial conditions and interest rates as the most important problem. This is shown in chart 13. There is one caveat to this. Credit constraints could be inhibiting the formation of new small businesses. This is something that surveys of existing firms would not capture. Although credit availability has begun to improve, the declining collateral values remains a significant impediment. For example, housing prices have declined so far that nearly one quarter of homes are now worth less than the value of the mortgages that finance them. Lacking sufficient collateral values, such homeowners cannot take advantage of the fact that conforming mortgage rates are at their lowest level in history, and so they can't refinance their mortgages. Overall, the desire to rebuild wealth through savings and the limits on credibility to households has acted to restrain consumer spending, keeping the recovery tepid. To some degree, this adjustment is unavoidable as the economy had reached unsustainable levels of consumption and housing demand. However, the fact that many of these adjustments are inevitable does not rule out a role for monetary policy to support economic activity. Very low interest rates can help smooth the adjustment process by supporting asset valuations, including making housing more affordable, and by allowing some borrowers to reduce their debt interest payments. Beyond this direct role in smoothing the deleveraging process, to the extent that monetary policy can cut off the tail of the distribution of potentially adverse outcomes, making a truly disastrous outcome less likely, it can help encourage those households and businesses with more money to spend to do so. Today's low and falling rate of inflation at a time when interest rates are near zero is a problem that is slowing this adjustment process. Currently, by most measures, inflation is below the level that members of the Federal Open Market Committee view as consistent with price stability. Although the Federal Reserve has no formal numerical inflation target, it is noteworthy that the long-run inflation forecasts of the FOMC members cluster around 1.75% to 2% for the personal consumption expenditures deflator. This compares with a 1.5% increase for this deflator on a year-over-year basis and 1.4% when we exclude food and energy prices. Low and falling inflation is a problem for several reasons. First, low and declining inflation makes it harder to accomplish the needed balance sheet adjustments. That is because, all other things being equal, lower inflation means slower nominal income growth. Slower nominal income growth, in turn, means that less of the needed adjustment in household debt to income ratios will come from rising incomes. That puts more of the adjustment burden on paying down debt. Second, and even more importantly, low and falling inflation can cause inflation expectations to decline. This is important because inflation expectations are an important factor that influence actual inflation. Moreover, when inflation expectations decline, the expected real cost of credit increases, and this is a subject I will return to in a moment. So what could the Federal Reserve do? As I see it, there are two potentially complementary avenues. First, we could take steps to make our current highly accommodative stance of monetary policy more effective in stimulating economic activity by providing additional guidance about what we are trying to achieve today and in the future. Second, we could find ways to increase the amount of stimulus we currently are providing through our balance sheet. Turning to the first issue, clear communications about objectives and intent is an important element of effective monetary policy. For example, communicating clearly our intention to return inflation to more normal levels can help keep inflation expectations well anchored around levels consistent with our long-term inflation goals. As the central bank, we and we alone can control inflation, if not precisely in the short run, then over the medium term. By clarifying our intentions, we can reduce the risk of further disinflation or even an outright debt deflation spiral that would make it still more difficult to accomplish the necessary balance sheet adjustments. Clear communication on our part is important at all times, but it's even more critical when the federal funds rate is at or near its effective lower bound. In this environment, a decline in inflation expectations that drives up the real interest rate and thereby increases the real cost of credit cannot be offset by simply lowering the federal funds rate further. Thus, in a very direct sense, a fall in inflation expectations when the target interest rate is at the zero bound reflects a de facto tightening of monetary policy and of financial conditions. Such a tightening would clearly be highly undesirable at this time when the unemployment rate is too high, inflation is too low, and the economy has only moderate forward momentum. In this situation, the FOMC must be clear and resolute in its commitment to its price stability objective. This is why the most recent FOMC statement clearly stated that underlying inflation was running somewhat below levels consistent with the dual mandate. There are a range of options we could pursue if we judge it worthwhile to go even further in communicating our objectives and intent. We could be even more explicit with regard to the inflation rate that the committee views as compatible with price stability. For instance, by stating an explicit inflation objective, as is common practice in many other advanced economies. This could help anchor inflation expectations at the desired rate. It would also clarify the extent to which the current level of inflation falls short of that rate. If we were to go down this path, it would be important to note that any provision of more information on our inflation objective would not be a signal that the inflation element of the dual mandate had become more important than the full employment objective. Instead, it would principally reflect the fact that inflation being too low, just like inflation being too high, is an impediment to achieving the full employment objective of the dual mandate. If we judged it desirable, we could go still further and provide more guidance on how monetary policy would react to deviations from any stated inflation objective. One possibility would be to keep track of inflation shortfalls when the federal funds rate is constrained by the zero bound as it is today. For example, if inflation in 2011 were a half a percentage point below the Fed's inflation objective, the Fed might aim to offset this miss by an additional half percent point rise in the price level in future years. In the current environment, such an approach would have some advantages as well as some disadvantages. When there's a large amount of slack in the economy, the Federal Reserve might not easily be able to hit an inflation objective soon. But the central bank could plausibly promise to make up the difference later on. Indeed, the further the Fed fell behind its inflation objective in the near term, the more inflation would need to increase in the future in order to push the actual path of prices up to the path consistent with price stability over the long run. To the extent this policy was more credible, it might do a better job keeping inflation expectations from falling. This might make monetary policy more stimulative and thus might help the FOMC achieve its objectives more quickly. However, such an approach would only work well if people understood how it would operate and form their expectations of future inflation accordingly. And there could also be significant costs. For example, if people mistakenly concluded that the Fed was tinkering with its long-run inflation objective, this could lead to greater uncertainty about future inflation. This might lead to higher risk premium and higher nominal interest rates, and this would undermine the effectiveness of such a policy to stimulate the economy. In addition to communication strategies, the Fed has a second set of tools, namely the ability to expand its balance sheet to stimulate activity and move inflation towards desired levels, either by purchasing medium and long-term treasury securities or agency mortgage-backed securities. Such purchases of long-duration assets pull down the level of long-term interest rates by removing duration from private sector hands who respond by purchasing other longer-dated assets. Two interesting questions pertain to balance sheet expansion. First, how much would the Fed have to purchase to have a given impact on interest rates in the economy? And second, what constraints exist in terms of limits to balance sheet expansion? And what are the costs involved that would impede efforts to meet the dual mandate now or in the future? These questions demand serious consideration prior to any decision to expand the balance sheet further. With respect to the first question, some simple calculations that are based on recent experience suggest that $500 billion of purchases would provide about as much stimulus as a reduction in the federal funds rate target by between a half a point and three quarters of a point. But I would caution that this estimate is sensitive to how long market participants expected the Fed to hold on to these assets. More broadly, the clearer and more credible the framework governing purchases, the greater the likelihood that market participants would act in a manner that helped the Fed achieve its objectives. In particular, the more confident market participants are in the Fed ability to exit when the time is right, the more effective its purchases will be in stimulating the economy. Suppose the Fed was indeed successful in reducing long-term interest rates further. What then? Some claim that lower rates would have no effect on economic activity, that the Fed would be pushing on a string. This is too dark a view. Although the responsiveness of demand to reductions in interest rates is probably lower in a world in which balance sheet constraints are important, the responsiveness is not zero. I believe that it remains significant. Even in today's challenging circumstances, lower long-term rates would support the economy through a number of channels. Lower long-term rates would support the value of assets, including houses and equities and household net worth. Lower long-term rates would make housing more affordable and support consumption by enabling more households to refinance their mortgages at lower rates. This would increase the amount of income left over for other spending. Of course, this channel can be made more powerful to the extent that further progress can be made in efficient mortgage debt restructurings that allow households with negative equity in their homes to take advantage of the drop in mortgage rates. In addition, lower long-term rates would reduce the cost of capital for business, thereby fostering higher levels of capital spending for any given economic outlook. In considering the limits to balance sheet expansion, there are two constraints, one major and one more minor. The first constraint is the risk that the balance sheet expansion might cause inflation expectations to become unanchored, leading to higher risk premium. This risk is presumably greater in a period in which budget deficits are high, as they are today. If exit concerns were to rise as purchases increase, then a rise in the inflation risk premium could conceivably offset at least some of the expected fall in interest rates. In contrast, the more credible the ultimate exit strategy, the less likely it is that inflation risk premium would go up, and the more effective purchases would be in lowering long-term rates. Also, the more credible the ultimate exit plan, the more confident investors would be about the Fed's willingness to do what is needed to accomplish its objectives. This is important because it would help stabilize longer-term inflation expectations at levels consistent with the dual mandate. The FOMC should be able to reassure investors that it has both the means and the will to exit when, but not before, the time is right. That is because the Federal Reserve has the tools to control financial conditions and credit creation, even with an enlarged balance sheet. Payment of interest on reserves allows us to control short-term rates with even a large amount of excess reserves in the system. In addition, we can drain excess reserves in several ways. We've developed term deposit accounts and the ability to conduct reverse repurchase operations with a large number of counterparties that would allow us to drain a large volume of reserves in a short period of time. Also, when the time is right, the Fed can always sell assets. Such asset sales would lead to a rise in longer-term rates, and this would have a contractionary effect on the demand for credit. I am very mindful of the concerns here and abroad that balance sheet expansion could be interpreted as a policy of monetizing the federal debt. However, I regard this view as fundamentally mistaken. It misses the point of what would be motivating the Fed. The FOMC would only engage in large-scale asset purchases in order to push the economy more rapidly to the dual mandate goals of full employment and price stability. Once these goals were accomplished, there would be no further basis for purchases, regardless of the government's fiscal positions, because additional purchases would not be consistent with this mandate. The second constraint is that further balance sheet expansion would increase the Federal Reserve's interest rate risk by raising the maturity mismatch between its assets and liabilities. Recall that the bulk of the Fed's liabilities are overnight reserves, and the bulk of its assets are longer-term treasuries, agencies, and agencies' mortgage-backed securities. The bigger the balance sheet becomes, the more a future rise in short-term interest rates will squeeze the Federal Reserve's net interest margin. Some worry that this exposure to higher short-term rates could conceivably affect the Federal Reserve's monetary policy credibility in the future. Some market participants might worry that the Federal Reserve could become reluctant to raise short-term rates in a timely way because this would constrain the amount of revenue that it would earn and remit to the Treasury. I am confident that there's nothing to worry about on this score. Even if the Federal Reserve was not obliged to act in keeping with this dual mandate, which it is, with its assets skewed towards long-duration securities, the Fed has every incentive to ensure price stability over the long term. It is true that the larger the size of the balance sheet, the more likely it is that the Fed would ultimately sell assets back into the market, and this could occur at prices that could result in losses. Although some fear that such losses could compromise the Federal Reserve's independence, there is no reason why this should be the case, providing we stick closely to our mandate at all times. To date, the Fed's actions in responding to the crisis have resulted in abnormally large profits that might reasonably be set against any subsequent losses. But much more importantly, our dual mandate does not state that we should do what is necessary to promote full employment and price stability only at times when we are virtually certain that doing so we will make a profit. It directs us to promote full employment and price stability at all times. Profits and losses in any given year are much less important than getting the U.S. economy back to the highest level of employment consistent with price stability. In making our assessments about next steps, we need to be a bit humble about our capacity to forecast how market participants would respond to our actions. We do not control their behavior, nor do we have much historical experience that we can draw on to easily assess how they are likely to react to what we do. Even viewpoints that turned out to be incorrect could persist for a long time and generate adverse consequences. It's not enough for us to be right in theory. We also have to be convincing in practice and explaining why concerns we think are misplaced are indeed unwarranted. As Chairman Bernanke indicated at Jackson Hole, the FOMC's decision with respect to providing additional accommodation will be made by weighing the costs against the benefits. This is a dynamic process which depends on the evolution of the economic outlook and our own ability to learn how to become more effective in improving the cost-benefit trade-offs. And at its last meeting in September, the FOMC said it is, quote, prepared to provide additional accommodation if needed to support the economic recovery and to return inflation over time to levels consistent with its mandate. Currently, my assessment is that both the current levels of employment and inflation and the time frame over which they are likely to return to levels consistent with our mandate are unacceptable. In addition, the longer this situation prevails and the U.S. economy is stuck with the current level of slack and disinflationary pressure, the greater the risk that a future shock could push us still further away from our dual mandate objectives and closer to outright inflation. We have tools that can provide additional stimulus at costs that do not appear to be prohibitive. Thus, I conclude that further action is likely to be warranted unless the economic outlook evolves in a way that makes me more confident that we will see better outcomes for both employment and inflation before too long. Thank you very much for your kind attention. I would be happy to take a few questions.
I'm going to start with a couple, and hopefully we'll have time for one or two from the audience. Last night, a group of us were over at Reuters hearing Joseph Stiglitz. And on a scale of 1 to 10, 1 being extremely pessimistic about the economy and 10 being optimistic, he was a 0. Where are you on that continuum, and would you give us a number?
Well, I think that I'm pretty optimistic that the economy, I mean, I'm actually quite optimistic that the economy is going to keep growing. I think we're on track for sort of 2% growth, and then the economy is going to gradually accelerate from there. What I'm less confident about is how fast we're going to get back to our objectives of full employment and price stability, and that's really what's frustrating us at the current time. I think the so-called double dip that people talk about, I think, is actually quite unlikely for a number of reasons. Policy is stimulative. As I discussed in my speech, credit availability is improving. The cyclically sensitive sectors of the economy, like housing and autos, are already operating at levels that are very depressed. And the rest of the world is growing at a decent rate. So the issue is, in my mind, it's not double dip. The issue is, how can we get the economy to grow faster so we get more quickly back to achieve our dual mandate?
So to follow up on that, as I listened to the speech, I heard a million coulds. You could do this, you could do that. What do you think is the best thing to do? And I understand this would be your personal opinion and not that speaking for the Fed.
The best thing to do would be to go to the November FOMC meeting and have a good, heartfelt discussion and then make a decision.
I also heard, and one of the great debates, of course, is whether this low interest rate policy is really good in the long term. And one member of the Open Market Committee, as we know, thinks the current policy is not a good idea because he keeps voting against it. And I heard this very interesting comment you made that the Fed could pursue a policy that would add half a percentage point to the inflation rate.
Let me correct you, Greg. That's not what I said. I said that we could follow a policy where if inflation fell a half percent below what we were looking for, we'd make up that half percent difference in future years. That does not mean that we would permanently accept a higher rate of inflation.
I understand. Could the Fed be that precise? And isn't there a risk, which we saw those of us who are older, who were around in the 70s, that efforts on your part could backfire down the road when we would have much larger inflation rates, which is after all, what the dissenting Fed governor is worried about?
Well, I think that it is very, very important before we engage in any policy that provides more accommodation to be absolutely confident that we can exit smoothly when the time comes. Because if we can't exit smoothly when the time comes, we're not going to be achieving our dual mandate over time. It's not about achieving our dual mandate just today or next year or the year after. It's over the long term. So the ability for us to exit on time in a way that doesn't lead to a longer term inflation problem is absolutely just as critical as getting the economy to grow faster today. So we think, as I said in my remarks, we have developed some really good tools that allow us to control credit expansion, even within a large balance sheet. People who are worried about our inability to do so, I think, are very much mistaken. I'm happy to sit down and talk to anyone at any time and explain, once again, why these tools will be effective in allowing us to exit without a long-term inflation problem.
So one of the things, if I can just finish on my comment, my questions with Stiglitz, he said there's nothing more the Fed can do. The Fed is out of power and out of tools, and his view was it had to be on the stimulus side. So you would disagree with it?
Well, as you heard in my remarks, of course I would disagree with it. We can do things, two major things, as I said in my remarks. One, we can improve our communications so that we can better anchor inflation expectations, which that's important because that means that it makes monetary policy more stimulative at the current level of interest rates. And two, we can consider a further balance sheet expansion. Now, is it true that everything, the Fed can do everything? Of course not. There's a lot of other steps that could be taken to support the economy. And one thing that I touched on in my remarks is that, you know, steps that could be taken to help let households that are locked into high-rate mortgages because the value of their homes are less than their mortgages to refinance to take advantage of lower interest rates. That would be a very, very welcome development. We could figure out how to do that.
Question in front.
Kevin Hall with the Appalachian Newspapers, who's from Touting Small Colleges and Overbrook University graduate. Last night we heard talk about also income inequality and the degree to which the lack of income growth and loss of this broad middle-class job base is creating a lack of aggregate demand. If I hear your speech right, you're saying it's really more the deleveraging that's a factor. What factor, Stiglitz suggests, and Robert Reich in his new book suggests, that we're looking at 8% unemployment as the new norm because of the lack of aggregate demand, because of a reshaping workforce. Can you talk a little bit about where you see the long-term unemployment rate?
Well, I don't think we know exactly where the long-term unemployment rate is going to be. There are some people that argue that the full employment rate will be somewhat higher as we go forward than it was going into the last downturn for a variety of reasons. One, that we really overshot in terms of construction activity. And two, there may be some people who are long-term unemployed and they may find it hard to find their skills, get back into the workforce. But clearly, the long-term unemployment rate is way below the 9.6% rate that we're at today. And that's really the important thing. I think a lot of this discussion about what the full employment rate is going to be in the future is really off point because we know it's far below where we are today. So what we need to do is start heading in that direction more forcefully. As we head in that direction, we'll learn more about what that full employment rate is in the future. But that's the story, I think, that we really need to worry about another day. Right now, we need to get the economy to grow more rapidly.
Is there any credibility to this idea of the income gap being one of the reasons we're not rebounding?
I think that it's certainly true that the income distribution has been more skewed. I haven't really seen much that that provides convincing evidence that this is a factor, an important factor, that's impeding the recovery.
Surely we have more questions. One over here, Steve.
Can you talk about the number that you think the Fed ought to do in terms of additional QE and how it ought to announce it? Would you favor announcing a large number at the outset or doing so incrementally?
That's why we have the November FOMC meeting, Steve. I'm not going to presume to speak for the FOMC or even prejudge what I'm going to be advocating at that meeting.
Way in the back, stand up and speak as loudly as possible.
Sure. To what extent are
The question is, to what extent are commercial real estate troubles in the New York area and the rest of the country inhibiting the recovery?
Well, the commercial real estate activity in terms of actual construction has already come down a lot, so that's probably not a very significant problem going forward. Where commercial real estate is going to have a little bit more lasting problem is on bank portfolios. A lot of the commercial real estate loans that they made, a lot of them are current. But the problem is that the value of the property is now worth less than the value of the loan. And so when the loan comes due, something is going to have to happen. There's going to be after some sort of restructuring. So this is going to put a little bit of pressure on some of these banks. Now, the good news about this commercial loan problem is it's not lumpy. It falls gradually over a series of different years, a little bit in 2011, some in 2012, and so on. So I don't think that this is going to be a huge constraint on the economy, but it's definitely going to be something that slows the recovery to health of banks that have large commercial real estate exposures.
You've spoken a bunch about the significance of the communication piece, and just as a student, I'm kind of confused about what's going on. I'm wondering if there's a more simple way to communicate all of these complex ideas.
Well, it is, you know, there's no question that there are communication challenges that face the Fed because we're in a very unusual environment where the interest rates are at the lower bound and we're using policy tools that we've never used before. So this is one reason why I'm here today, and this is really why I wanted to speak to this issue. The better we can lay out all the issues, assess them fairly, and reassure people about what's likely to actually to happen, that's good, because that will reduce the dispersion of uncertainty. That will limit uncertainty. And in the extent that people are less uncertain, the world is a less risky place, and that will improve the probability of having a good outcome. So it is a challenge. It is complicated stuff. We haven't done a lot of this before, but that's why I'm here giving the speech.
You know, you suggested that the commercial real estate problem is not that extreme. Many people are worried that that will contribute to a real erosion of bank quality. There are probably going to be more bank failures next year even than there are this year. What is your assessment of how solid or not solid banks are?
Well, you know, as I said in my remarks, there's a real differentiation between the largest banks and the smaller banks. The largest banks were forced through the supervisory capital assessment process to go out and raise a lot more capital, make sure they had enough capital, even for a stress environment, an environment worse than what we actually had. And so most of the largest banks are in quite good condition. The smaller banks had more of a concentration of commercial real estate and weren't forced to raise as much capital. And so their workout's going to be a little bit longer. But I think the important thing to focus on is not really the condition of the banks, but what's the consequence of that in terms of credit availability. And the good news there, as you saw, is that credit conditions are no longer being tightened, and some banks are actually starting to ease credit. So if you think about it in terms of the change in credit availability is becoming more available today, and that's very helpful.
Do you expect... you won't tell us what you're going to say at the November FOMC meeting. I guess, do you expect there to be news? Do you expect there to be the kind of action that will get the TV cameras excited?
We'll have to wait and see, Steve.
I think we're out of time. I have a 9:15 cutoff point. I want to thank you very much for a very...